You're listening to Yale Radio WYBC. This is Brainerd Carey with the lives of the artists, architects, curators, and more.
Today on our show, we're talking with Kianoush Montalebi. Kianoush, thanks so much for being with me today.
Thank you for having me.
And where are you now? Where am I talking to you from?
At the moment, I'm in Delft. I was actually doing a day of storage clearing, because I'm about to move to Brussels. So I'll be living between Holland and Belgium.
And what is it that you're working on now? What's your current project or most recent project that you're working on?
I'm working on a few things, but right now I'm working on a video. It's a video animation, and it's based on the Phaistos disk, which is quite an enigmatic object from Crete, found in the early 20th century. And it's the only example of such a disk found on the whole island, and it contains a language that to this day hasn't been deciphered. And the reason for that is they don't have enough glyphs. If they would have slightly more hieroglyphs, they would have been able to decipher this thing long ago, but that context isn't there, so it's always going to be undeciphered. And I knew about this disk for a long time because I studied Greek when I was younger, and this object was part of one of our lessons, and it's always been in the back of my mind. And I became more interested in the undeciphered element, not to what it actually means, but what does an undeciphered ancient language means? Because for me, that object becomes more about containing time. So I decided to appropriate these signs, these ancient symbols, in a video that's now in progress. And it's basically, I somehow had the instinct to make a 3D animation consisting of neon signs that are based on these glyphs, and that's probably because of the association of neon signs and language. And the work takes you through these neon lights together, accompanied by music. This is a bit geeky, but accompanied by music from games set in ancient times. So you have a lot of role-playing games on a computer in the 90s and the early 2000s that were based in those times, ancient Greek times. And in a funny way, the work also refers to how to create a sense of an ancient past without actually accessing it, which is what the magic of these kinds of objects is. You see them and you get a sense of time without actually knowing what it says. The work is really in progress because there are a whole set of steps I need to take to finish it. And it'll be set in various scenarios. And hopefully I'll be showing it, if I get my act together, by the end of this month.
So let's talk more about that. So this is this disc that's found. I mean, it's kind of like a different version of a Rosetta Stone, right? I mean, well, maybe not really with a Rosetta Stone, because that had multiple languages on it. But this was this disc that you're talking about, where these glyphs come from. Was that meant as a type of a book or a text of some kind that would have been in a library or something like that? Is that correct?
Well, I think they don't really know because they can't really. I mean, there are people who dispute whether it's a language at all. They are a minority because there's simply no way of translating it. So it has all the looks of language. It's systematic enough for that. There seems to be breaks and repetitions, but I think there's just not enough of them. So I think people just don't really know what this served. It could be a prayer, it could be a receipt, it could be a number of things. It could be an elaborate abstract drawing, but I guess you will never know for sure.
Right. That's very interesting. So when you put together this video, which I've seen, and there'll be a link to it, I believe, in this interview, you were, in a sense, it's offering this language for possible decoding. It's almost how I read it, because as I initially saw that video, I'm thinking to myself, what are these symbols? And they're kind of fascinating. How do you see people looking at it? I mean, I'm looking at it in a way of, how could I decode this? And if so, how? But
in a very basic level, I'm interested in the fact that we can recognize something as being a symbol. You know, just that it is a symbol. It's you don't see it. At least that's what I'd like people to get from it. That these are symbols. And how is it that time can add meaning to something? Like even though we don't have an idea of what this object really means, what it says, it's incredibly valuable. It's in a museum. It's unique, and the fact that it's so old gives it a value that somehow. I mean, I find it hard to put in words, but it kind of transcends language in that way because it's valuable, but not in the sense that it contains information. It essentially contains some form of noise. But time has somehow taken away its literal meaning, whatever it was, whether it was a receipt or a prayer, and it's given it something much more, I guess, primal. The meaning for it now is primal, it's mystique. And that is, to an extent, what I want the piece to convey, much more of an emotion, a sense of time, rather than actual talking about it. If you know what I mean.
I do, and this is something that you've, or at least I think I do, this is something that you've worked with for a while, correct? This kind of ancient cultures and marrying it or bridging it to a kind of contemporary technology?
Well, I mean, this is a fairly new move in my practice because I tend to stick to fairly scientific themes from the natural sciences, physics, chemistry, but I think what connects it is my interest in constants and things that essentially don't change throughout time, certain unknowns. And I mentioned to you in an email that I'm working on a current project that's dealing with the history or the ancient history of the Middle East and its connection to the now. That actually started some time ago. Over the summer, I did a residency at Skowhegan School of Sculpture and Painting, and I decided, for a set of reasons that are too long to explain now, I somehow decided to buy an ancient artifact off the internet. And I found this gallerist in New York who, you know, sent me this tablet. At this point, I'm pretty sure he sent me a fake. But anyway, I spent some money on it, and it caused all sorts of crises for me because I kind of knew as soon as I saw it, this can't be real. It just didn't feel right. So I, at the time, not knowing what to do with this kind of a weird pink elephant in my studio, I decided to do something drastic to it, deface it. So I had it sent over I went to this place in Boston where they could laser etch it. I wanted the signature to be laser etched on it, and that signature would be the signature of the dealer who gave me this, so sold me this object as a way of defacing, but literally putting his authenticity on it because he was the one who was telling me this is the real deal, which I don't think it was.
And just to interrupt you for a minute, the dealer is a dealer of antiquities, I imagine, of some kind.
Yeah.
He
focuses on, I'm not going to say who it is, but he's a notorious guy, and at the time, I don't know what I was thinking, I just thought, okay, I'll buy it, looks good, I'll get it, but I think I was wrong. But that wasn't really the point, because even though I was really upset that this wasn't the real thing, I somehow got interested in the fact that opening this object that, you know, at the end of the day, I would never know whether it's really real, it could always be an immaculate, a really good fake, but somehow its value, its physical, the way I touched it, its weight really felt like it reduced as soon as I kind of figured out it was fake. And this act of putting his signature on it was kind of I wouldn't even call it artwork, but it was part of a thinking process that was wondering what does an ancient document actually mean, or what makes it powerful, what is that. So anyway, that's why I started looking more into the kind of ancient history, I'm drawn to the Middle East because I'm from there. But and I was researching ancient wars at some point, and it turned out. Oh, actually, I should say something else. This is a side project that I'm doing, but So when I laser etched this thing, it turned into glass. A large part of it literally turned into glass because of the heat. And as soon as I found that out, I realized this thing must be made of sand. It's some kind of sandstone that he's carved himself. And that fascinated me because sand is essentially the raw material of the semiconductor industry. That sand is, you know, purified silica are what computer chips are made of. And I'm not exactly sure where I'm going to go with this project, but the connection between information being stored on an ancient tablet made of sand, and sand being the main product of the semiconductor industry where we distribute our information on, really fascinated me, and it still does. And there are all sorts of things I'm looking into right now that relate to that. But to go back specifically to the Middle East, I was looking at the first wars. You know, things are happening in the world, and I got interested in the history of war in that part of the world. And it turns out that the very first recorded war, which was 2700 BC, was actually on the border of Iran and Iraq. And by chance, this is the exact same spot the Iranians and the Iraqis fought some 5,000 years later. I just found that, it's kind of macabre to say, but I found that very beautiful. There was some kind of dark beauty within the fact that the area of the world were known as the cradle of life, of civilization. There have been wars there, and there's still wars there at the very same spot. I think if an alien would look at this, he would find it funny. Right now what I'm looking into is literally the invasion map of this first war, which is between the Elamites and the Sumerians, and the literal ground movements that were done by the armies then. And I want to somehow superimpose this on an image of a war map between Iran and Iraq back in the 80s. And the idea is to put this all on a tapestry, on a Persian carpet. And I guess I want to do that because Persian carpets have been around there all along. So it somehow, I think, is a good medium for this piece to exist in. But that's a long way from happening, because I just was talking to some people about the making of Persian carpets, and it's not one of those easy things. It'll take quite some time.
But that would be the final object, so to speak, or perhaps one of the final objects.
I think one of the, because I have a feeling this can be one, and that's something that I'm becoming increasingly interested in, the fact that, I guess it's inherent to any kind of conceptual work, but I'm interested in the fact that a work of art can exist in different media at the same time. It says something about ideas and how they can change. So ideally, this is just the beginning point, and it's all in my head. I haven't actually managed to make something physically out of this, so I'm hoping that a lot will change. I can see it existing as a drawing, maybe, or something on the internet.
And because the work is research-based, and it sounds like there's a lot of process involved until objects come along, how does your work enter the marketplace, you know, or in other words, is it sold, and if so, how?
Well, I guess a lot of my work is, and this has to do with the context I'm working in as well, which is Holland, and a lot of work that is like mine can exist outside of the market. So through a variety of project grants and exhibitions, I can distribute this work. But within a commercial setting, whether it's sold, I guess they can sell everything.
But you're able to, it seems such an unusual situation in Holland. I talked to artists there before. You're able to support yourself through grants, residencies, special projects, without having to do other work, or is that in addition?
Well,
I guess there's
a variety of ways. I can't speak for everyone, because there are plenty of artists who don't work with grants at all. But in my case, I get it through various means, like commissions. I recently had a really nice commission through the Dutch Mint to design a coin. And although that's not, I don't consider that art, but it has come come through me exhibiting and people getting to know my work and then putting me forward to that for that. So I do see a relation, but obviously that coin wouldn't be an artwork, but it's a side, it's kind of like another way of earning money with my work in Holland. Other than that, it is grants and exhibitions. Occasionally I've sold something, but that's always been through, there's never been through a gallery, it's always been through myself.
But designing a coin, I mean, that's really cool. Can you tell me a little bit more about that? Though that's not art, it seems to have a relationship to the disc you're talking about.
Definitely. I think all of these things, they're relationships, because it took me ages designing it, because I'm not a designer. I haven't been trained that way, so I had a really hard time with it. So the investment in time in that has definitely affected this for projects that I'm working on now. I mean, coins are probably one of the most fascinating ways human beings have exchanged throughout history, and that has definitely been part of the background of these projects. And earlier I said I'm really interested in how a work can exist in different media. I think, and that's why I think it's fascinating to work across disciplines sometimes, because you realize that you never know where you end up. It's like ideas can transfer between media, but something changes. So when I was designing this coin, I had quite a clear brief, you know. It has to be that, it has to be this, and you design it. Make sure it can communicate to a very broad audience. So, but the concept of the coin as in being something small but valuable and something that's going to outlast me as a human being, definitely feeds back into my practice, because I'm very much interested in objects and what they are after their beholders no longer exist, which is why I'm interested probably in wars in particular, because there is something quite tragic and beautiful about a war being continued on the exact same spot where we came from. There's a certain unchanging element in that fascinates me.
And the coin, what is the coin, what will it be used for? Is it a common currency?
Yeah, it'll be its currency. It's a commemorative coin, so it's mainly directed towards collectors. There are various versions of it you can get. There's one that's for general circulation, so they'll make many of those. I think it's like 50,000-60,000. I'm not sure how many, but a lot. And there's a smaller edition that is much more, that's nicer, and that's just for collectors. And it's going to span over 3 years. So there's one coin for 2015, and there's actually three coins: 2015, 2016, and 2017. So,
and the ones that are in regular circulation are ones that people are going to use to buy things and keep in their pockets, like
any
other.
Yeah, I don't
thing.
Think they will though. It's because those are, it's still. Yeah, I guess maybe it's possible. I wouldn't if I was them. It's 60, because it's still a fairly rare edition. I doubt people will, but they could. It could well be that one day you would come across one.
But that's a fascinating commission. I mean, although, again, as you say, it's not your art. It seems to have such a direct relation. Coins are one of the few things that last, you know, 1,000 years or more. There's not many other objects on the earth like that, really.
No, I that's exactly. I mean, the as I speak to you with you about it, I'm actually it's quite illuminating to kind of look back on, because this started, this coin commission, quite some time ago. I think it was 2014, because it was quite a big technical process. But to talk to you about it is quite interesting, to then see what I'm making now, what I'm interested in, and it's definitely fed back into that.
And how did that commission came about? That came about, that's a kind of a state-sponsored commission, or
no?
I mean,
I think the Ministry of Finance. They commission commemorative coins every once in a while, and this was one of those. And there's a jury of people who proposed people. There were architects and artists. And I think there were like six or seven of us, and we were all commissioned to make an initial design. And then out of those designs, they would select one, and I was lucky enough to be selected. And
fascinating.
That, and, and, And some of the, and I'm pretty sure the jury, one of the jury probably knew my work, and that's how I was introduced to the committee in the first place. So that's, I think that's how it goes with these things.
And at the moment, you're moving, it sounds like. What happens, what will happen in the immediate future? And if you don't mind me asking, why the move?
Well, Brussels is a very interesting city, and I've been living in Amsterdam for quite some time, and we, I don't know, in a funny way, Brussels is really at the heart of Europe, you know, it's between Paris, London, and Amsterdam, and I really like that connection it has with us, with the rest of Europe. It makes it so easy to be, because I'm still going to be in Holland, like, pretty much most of the time, but it's good to be based there. Because it has a very interesting art scene. It's also very different to Holland, and I always like a change. And you can get really nice studios there, which is something that's becoming increasingly difficult in Amsterdam, or the rest of Holland, really. That was for me, that was one of the main reasons to do that. It's just become, real estate's gone insane here. So, and Brussels is lagging behind a little bit. I'm sure it'll change in a few years.
But it does seem that Holland has more support of the arts. I mean, I talk to people in a lot of different countries. Sweden also has quite a bit. But it seems that Holland has, from my understanding, and I really have a very naive understanding of it, that Holland seems to have an enormous amount of support for the arts. Do you see it that way or no?
I think, I mean, it's very strange because I used to live in London for a while, and I think I know a little bit about the British system. And the funny thing is that they actually have a larger budget for art, but it's a way that Holland spends its budget that is fundamentally different. And I think, I'm pretty sure, quite unique in the world. The main funding bodies, I think they focus on not necessarily, still they don't necessarily focus on end result. They will fund projects that are essentially open-ended. And as a result, you open up yourself to a much broader set of artists. There are all sorts of projects that I cannot see being funded elsewhere, being funded in Holland. And I think they have the Mondrian Foundation I know quite well, they have a very good understanding of what an artist's practice is, and that not everything should or can go according to plan. And that's why they have a more open-minded view on funding. And even though their budget is smaller, in my opinion, they managed to fund a much larger number of people with that, because they're not necessarily focusing on massive exhibitions. They're not necessarily just focusing on solos in Kunsthalles or projects that cost 400,000 euros. It's much broader than that.
Right.
And that's very unique to Holland. I think it's really good, and I hope it continues to operate like that.
I hope so, too. I hope some of that, you know, moves over to the United States, because the United States has nothing like that, or very little. In closing this interview, it's been great talking to you. Is there anything you want to leave viewers with in terms of places to find your work? There will be links in this video of your website, and perhaps videos and other things.
I have a show coming up in about a month, 27th of February in Utrecht, if any of you Americans happen to be there. It's a really cool setting. It's a group exhibition in a really interesting historical prison, and I'll be showing a piece there and showing a video there. So that's one place you can find me.
Well, Kanish, it's really been a pleasure talking to you. Thank you so much for talking with me today.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
You're listening to Yale Radio WYBC. This is Brainerd Carey with the lives of the artists, architects, curators, and more.